The Athletic.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of the Zonal Marking Podcast, which is brought to you by The Athletic. And it's brought to you excitedly this week by me, Ali Maxwell, and with me as ever, Michael Cox, the tactical writer for The Athletic, who spent this weekend watching and writing about Leicester City, about Brendan Rodgers' Foxes. And Tom Warville was at an EFL Championship game, Brentford against Barnsley, and has written all about Brentford FC, really interesting side who we may or may not see in the Premier League next year on The Athletic site. But we're getting straight into some action this week on the podcast because we are absolutely buzzing about the return of the Champions League. The round of 16 kicks off on Tuesday night. I'm actually going to mix things up a little bit by starting this week with a quiz question or two for you guys, just to mull over. Listener, Michael, Tom, listen to this, have a think, write down your answers and we'll come to them at the end of the episode. Question one of this Champions League special quiz is, who were the first two Englishmen to score in a Champions League final? Now, one key bit of information there is, of course, the rebrand from European Cup to Champions League. This is very much the first two Englishmen to score in a Champions League final. Michael writing, Tom shaking his head. Second question, before we move on and get stuck into the episode, this is a bit of a who am I? In the 2004 Champions League final between Monaco and Porto, Monaco had three forwards on the bench. Dado Perso, Shabani Nonda, and one other. Now, Perso and Nonda both came on in this game. They were both subbed on. But this third forward was an unused sub, a young striker, who subsequently played for Real Madrid and four Premier League clubs, but sadly never made it onto the pitch in a Champions League final, never appeared in one. Right, pop your answers down, guys. We'll take a look at the end of the episode to see if you've got them right. But of course, this is really just a teaser for the definitive Champions League quiz, which is on the Athletic site at the moment, put together by far better quiz masters than me. I know Michael was involved in it as well. TheAthletic.com/zonal marking. If you're listening to this and you're not a subscriber of The Athletic, head on to the site and play the quiz today. Tell us how you get on Twitter as well. Until February the 25th, new subscribers will get a half price annual subscription, less than £1 a week for an entire year, to read everything that Tom and Michael and all of their colleagues are writing on site. But let's get our teeth into the Champions League knockout stage, the round of 16 first. We're going to go through each team, each fixture with a tactical analytical filter on. Michael and Tom, armed and ready. We'll start with Barcelona against PSG. This one's on Tuesday night. Michael, Barcelona heading into this game. Ronald Koeman, the manager, has really sort of gone round the houses this season to settle on a tactical shape. Would you say he's settled now? Can we accurately predict how Barca will look heading into Tuesday night?
Yeah, probably. I mean, he's settled on a 4-3-3 with Messi deep as a central forward and two more on-rushing forwards going in behind from wide. So it's not a new system, really. It's the kind of system we would associate with Barcelona 10 years ago. Yeah, they do look a little bit more settled. I mean, the results show that they've won the last six, I think, in La Liga. They go into this with a little bit more momentum than they had at any stage in the group phase. Yeah, the midfield is working well. I think that's, you know, over the years with Barcelona, we always think about the midfield, I think, first and foremost, because it's, you know, the area where they've always concentrated on. They've got Frankie de Jong. It's been a funny one. When Koeman came to Barcelona, he said, well, I'm not going to use de Jong where he's been used before. I'm going to use him where he played with Ajax and where he's played with the Netherlands, which was kind of as a deep midfielder charging forward on the ball at times. He's actually played as the most advanced, really, of the three central midfielders, getting into goal-scoring positions, but he's done that very well. Pedri alongside him is very neat and tidy. I think very typically Barcelona has had a really good couple of months. The concern for me is Busquets, who's been okay in the league recently, but I think back to the Clásico earlier in the season that Real Madrid won 2-0, I think it was, and his lack of mobility was very obvious. And I do worry against the real elite sides in Europe whether he'll be able to cope with that kind of test.
And Tom, in terms of the numbers, I mean, the group stage numbers for Barcelona were really impressive, but you have to take into account the level of opponent, and up against PSG this time around, that is being raised significantly.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they were unbeaten in the group apart from losing to Juve in the last round of matches, and yeah, it's going to be a much higher level of competition against PSG and whoever they play afterwards if they make it past the next stage. So yeah, there was always a bit of a small sample klaxon with the graphics and the data in this piece, just because we are looking at six games and the quality of opposition is pretty different group to group. But I mean, Barcelona were heavily dominant possession in the final third. They weren't too aggressive in their pressing. They're actually ranked eighth, which is obviously middle of the road for Champions League sides when we look at PPDA, but they were taking the most shots as well. So I'm excited to see how they're tested against PSG. I'd agree with Michael that Busquets is definitely a bit of a question mark, especially with the speed that PSG have, that, you know, they'll be using and probably playing on the counter and trying to make the most of transition situations if this is going to be kind of a classic Pochettino PSG side. But I'm excited to see how Serginho Dest at right back and Ronald Araujo at right centre back plays. That is a kind of relatively new look Barcelona right hand side of defence, and we've been very used to seeing very different players there in the past. So that's the one area where they're, I guess, a bit more inexperienced. It'll be interesting to see if PSG try and target that.
Fair to say it's a concern for the fan base. I enjoyed a Barca fan in the comments of your piece saying there's no chance we don't concede at least six goals over the two legs here. So really heading into that with some positivity. Michael, are PSG a classic Poch team? As Tom just said, they're not top of league, aren't heading into this, of course, but they have won six of their last seven in that competition. How are they shaping up?
Yeah, difficult to tell. I've seen a couple of their games under Pochettino. I mean, they're quite compact. They look well organised, but it's difficult to judge. I mean, at the weekend, they beat Nice and they played a 4-2-3-1 that had Moise Kean on the right wing. And I just can't imagine them doing that in the Champions League. I could be wrong. He could be bold. He could try and attack Barcelona more than we would expect. But it's such a step up from Liga into the Champions League. I think probably more so than any other side. Well, I guess Porto actually are in the same situation. But PSG are just so dominant in the league. I think they end up using tactics for individual games that we won't see in the Champions League. But yeah, they look decent. The Neymar absence is obviously a big thing. He's definitely out of the first leg. He might come back for the second leg because there's a bit of a gap between, obviously. I find it difficult to tell. The one thing I think is worth saying is they were a good side last year. I mean, they got to the final and I thought they were the better team in the final. So we're not talking about PSG as in, can they really finally do it in Europe? I mean, they were a good team and I don't think Pochettino needed to change that much from last year's structure. And indeed, when Neymar's been fit, it's been a very familiar side from last year, with the exception of Thiago Silva, who obviously is no longer there. But that just means Marquinhos stepped into the defence, which is his proper position. Otherwise, they're pretty familiar. And I think they could be quite a force. I'd make them favourites for this tie against Barcelona.
PSG by numbers, Tom Warville, what stands out to you?
Yeah, the key stat that we had for them was that they were the most fouled side in the group stage, drawing 96 fouls, which I think is equal to the number that Jack Grealish has got in the whole of the Premier League so far this season. And obviously that partly is going to be due to Neymar, and with him missing or likely missing, you know, maybe that means that they won't be as dribbly as attacking through carrying upfield from deep. But I'm excited to see how they play. I mean, a lot of the data we have in the piece on PSG is obviously based around Tuchel's sides. So I am excited to see this Pochettino team, and I have to be honest, I haven't actually seen them at all under Poch yet, so really look forward to this tie.
That sounds like a really intriguing tie. Actually, you've given us information there, but I quite enjoy your uncertainty in some ways. That makes me quite really intrigued and interested to watch that game. Leipzig-Liverpool also on Tuesday night. Michael, we'll start with Leipzig. With Nagelsmann, as you've written in the piece, you sort of expect the unexpected. He's very hard to predict tactically, which is, quite troubling for you as a tactics writer, but enjoyable when you get to watch his teams play, no doubt.
Yeah, I'm fundamentally biased towards teams that are relatively predictable in their lineups, just so I can get a hang of them. But no, I mean, they're a really good team tactically. I think they could really cause Liverpool problems, actually. I mean, the thing about Liverpool, and I don't really buy the idea that they've been worked out, as some people say. I think it's, you know, there's other issues there. But I think Nagelsmann will obviously have had a really good look at them over a period of time. And I think will have devised something specifically for this game. What that might be, I don't know. I mean, he likes 4-3-3-1, sometimes 3-5-1-1, which we saw certainly in the knockout stages last year. They're very good at rotating the positions. There was a game in the knockout phase last year where they did some great stuff on the right flank with the right wing back coming inside and the right-sided central midfielder overlapping. I think it was Sabitzer and Lime at that point. But in recent weeks, they've done it with Tyler Adams, the young American. Quite a few Americans actually in the Champions League knockout phase. Be interested to see some stats on that. Yeah, I mean, I think they've got a really good chance here. Liverpool, obviously, not in a great state at the moment. And I think Leipzig are just really, really flexible. They can match the intensity of Liverpool. You know, whether Liverpool are playing with great intensity at the moment is another question. But yeah, I think they've got a chance to cause what would be quite a big upset here, I think.
Tom, you watched Barnsley on Sunday and they play with great intensity and they play with an incredibly young side. And if that's what you enjoy watching, then Leipzig are the team for you in the Champions League, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think obviously there's probably they're a bit higher, a bit better technically. But yeah, there is that element of them where they're also the youngest side left in the group, in the knockout phases, sorry. The average weighted age of their players on field was 25, just over 25. 5 years old, which is actually joint with Red Bull Salzburg as well, which shows that there's a kind of consistent plan across that group of clubs. But also, I mean, yeah, they are hard to pin down tactically, but personnel-wise, they actually use the fewest players in the group stages as well, with only 19. So I think we have a decent idea of who's on the pitch. It's just where they're lining up and how their roles and responsibilities might differ. But yeah, they were kind of the highest pressing team in the group stages. They weren't incredible going forwards. They're looking at the numbers, they're kind of 10th for shots and 14th for quality of shots. So went against my thoughts a little bit in terms of I thought they were probably one of these sides that produced low volume, high quality chances. But definitely this game is going to be full of high tempo, full of pressing, full of running, and probably, you know, more likely to be a very energetic and entertaining affair.
From one team that's hard to predict, Michael, to another that's probably slightly easier, not just tactically, but in terms of personnel, just because of the injury issues that Liverpool have. It's a lot of doom and gloom surrounding the club at the moment after 3 defeats in a row in the league and a title defence that is all but over already. What do you think are their greatest issues at the moment heading into this tie?
Well, it stems from the lack of centre-backs. I know that's the obvious thing to say, but I mean, they're without any. And obviously that means they've put Henderson and Fabinho generally in there. Their defensive record until the last couple of weeks was actually pretty good in the Premier League. They weren't conceding many goals, but there's been a knock-on effect in terms of how they win the ball back. I think in terms of how they use the ball in midfield, I think Van Dijk has been as much of a loss for his passing as his defensive qualities. I think there's then a secondary issue with a bit of fatigue. I think the club was a little bit guilty this time last year of not rotating enough when they'd pretty much sewn up the title by Christmas. And I think we are starting to see a bit of fatigue from the forward players in particular. They don't play with as much intensity as they used to. I think that's obvious. Tom has written very conclusively that is actually a pattern in the Premier League this year. Not many teams are, well, I think only Aston Villa when he did the piece were pressing more than last year. So there's a few issues. And I think now there's probably almost another issue of not just mental fatigue, but they don't have momentum. They're not winning games. There is a bit of doom and gloom around the club for the first time in a few years, probably the first time under Klopp, really. And I think for a club like Liverpool that is, I think more than other clubs, it's based on emotion, things like momentum, things like, you know, a big European night at Anfield. They do count for things and they can't depend on either of those things at the moment. So, I fear for them. They've been a really, really good Champions League side over the last 3 years, but I don't really rank them as one of the favourites this time around.
Quite interesting this, Tom, because they're still actually, with the bookmakers anyway, heavy favourites to qualify. But in previewing this game, it's hard not to feel quite enthused by Leipzig and concerned about Liverpool. Have you got anything that you can add on top when it comes to Liverpool?
Yeah, I just feel like kind of for Liverpool, this tie kind of lives and dies with how they decide to set up in midfield. Because of the intensity of Leipzig, they just really need to ensure that they have that balance in there. And you can probably expect to see Wijnaldum will be in there. I've been intrigued to see whether it's Curtis Jones in there with him and Thiago. I think that is a really interesting one, whether Kabak gets thrown in at the back and Henderson can move back into midfield. I just feel that the amount of pressure the rest of the team will be under is just so important for this team to use the midfield to disrupt and move the ball around the field. We know who the attacking players are going to be. We know who the fullback's going to be. We know who one of the centre-backs are going to be. I think it very much lives and dies of how you control the game in the middle of the park and whether Thiago can... I don't know. It feels like in recent weeks he's probably got some stick, or maybe he's not been as good as we'd expect, but I think that this is definitely a good stage for him to show that he is a good Liverpool signing and he has been worthy of the investment.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Yeah, and the exciting ties come thick and fast. On Wednesday night, Sevilla against Dortmund, not only two great destinations for a European football weekend trip, but also, Michael, in Sevilla, a side in brilliant nick, having won five on the bounce in La Liga. What's their tactical style under Lopetegui?
I think they're a really good side, first and foremost. Their tactical style, it's a bit of a hybrid. I think they can control possession at times, but they're also very good on the counter-attack. I think over the years, Sevilla have seemingly produced a lot of great wingers, and they play with a lot of width here. They switch the play well. They've got wingers who can come inside, but also fullbacks who overlap. I mean, one of the great wingers, as I just mentioned, would be Jesus Navas, who's now a right-back and actually a very good one. The interesting thing really with them is En-Nesyri up front, who's kind of, he's just having a great season. He's having one of those seasons where I'm not sure it will be sustainable. I'm not sure how well he will continue this into the next few seasons. Might not be at Sevilla. I think he's linked with West Ham very strongly at the moment. But I remember having a chat with Tom a couple of months ago, about Arsenal's we could do. And one of them was finding the kind of last great poacher in European football. Someone who just scores goals, doesn't do anything else. I wouldn't quite put him in this category, En-Nesyri, but he scored 13 goals and got zero assists, which I think shows his style very nicely.
He's a physical player as well, isn't he? And I've certainly seen it suggested that this season that he's having, with all due respect, could be something of a hot streak, that he wasn't necessarily considered this like innate goal scorer, certainly before this season. But often it's a case of developing as a player and finding the right team, I suppose. Just quickly, Michael, there was a viral clip, wasn't there, a few weeks ago of Sevilla scoring a goal in a Copa del Rey game against Valencia. 37 passes or something astounding right from the very back, playing through the press and just a magnificent piece of football. Is that not necessarily what we should expect to see? You know, was that a little bit of a bit of a red herring in a sense?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think that one of these sides, I mean, Lopetegui is a very good coach, has often not been a great manager, if you know what I mean. I think he's great on the training ground, maybe sometimes with the politics of situations, he hasn't covered himself in glory. But I mean, he's one of these coaches who, a little bit like Sarri, I would say, he quite likes drawing the press and then allowing your side to play through it quickly. So you have this blend of counter-attacking and possession football that is, it feels like a counter-attack, but actually the opposition haven't been attacking, if that makes sense. They've been pressing. So that could be interesting here in this game against Dortmund. I'm looking forward to watching Sevilla, actually. I think they're a good team. I think maybe a little bit like we've seen in the domestic leagues, this could be a little bit of a year of the underdog. I think not necessarily in terms of them winning it, but I think in terms of this round, there could be a couple of upsets. And I guess they start this game as underdogs, certainly in terms of reputation in the last 2 years, because they're a Europa League side, really, aren't they? But I think they've got a very good chance of putting out Dortmund here.
Tom, it's not that long ago that you got a bit cross on this podcast when you heard Arteta talking about crossing. But from a Sevilla point of view, that's something that they do quite a lot, and more specifically, that they do pretty well. It's an effective tactic for them.
Yeah, like Michael said, they've got Jesus Navas on the right-hand side and Marcus Acuna on the left, and they're crossing, you know, for Sevilla more than any other side in the competition. And they also created 18 chances in the group stages, which is the most as well. So there's another stat as well, which I think highlights perfectly what we'll probably see. And it's the fact that Sevilla had the second most shots in the group stages, but on average, in terms of XG per shot, that was the lowest, like kind of 0.1 XG per per shot. And I think you have to highlight that's because of Suso is one of these players who loves to cut in and always try and kind of bend it into the top far corner and invariably never really pays off. So that's one thing to look out for, overlapping fullbacks, kind of underlapping Suso. And then Lucas Ocampos as well, who had a fantastic season last season, scored 14 goals. This year, he's only got 4 domestically, I think, from about 7 XG. So he's been a little bit unfortunate, but he's one who doesn't really strike me as a kind of out and out winger. He feels like a player with the physique of a striker who's playing out wide. And yeah, interesting to see where him kind of pop in the box and cut him from out wide as well. And then, yeah, Luke de Jong up front as kind of fodder for En-Nesyri, is a very physical striker who I think he scored the winning goal in the Europa League final last year and seems to be one who pops up with important goals on European nights. So, yeah, intrigued to see him off the bench at some point in the tie two.
They're up against Borussia Dortmund, Michael. Actually, some breaking news on the Dortmund front today with Marco Rose, the current Borussia Mönchengladbach manager, set to join Dortmund as manager in the summer for next season. First and foremost, though, when we're looking ahead to this fixture, what sort of shape are Dortmund in since Lucien Favre left in December?
Not great. Edin Terzic was his assistant, has taken over as caretaker. I guess was hoping to do a bit of a flick and have a really good half season and get the job on a permanent basis. I don't think there was much danger of that happening, to be honest. The results haven't been good. He's put a lot of faith in Marco Reus, who's been playing as a number 10 and hasn't been in great form. But they do have forwards who can just change the game in an instant. We know about Haaland. Jadon Sancho probably had a little bit of a dip earlier in the season, but when I've seen him in the last month or two, he's been back towards his best. Yeah, I'm not sure that they will dominate this game, but with those forwards, I wouldn't rule them out. Yeah, just because of the individual brilliance. But I think this is quite a poor Dortmund side by the standards of the last 10 years. And like I say, I do fancy Sevilla to cause a bit of a shock and put them out.
Well, you've referenced their sort of recent history in the last decade or so. Tom, I still have very fond memories of Dortmund under Klopp swarming all over the opposition in the opposition's defensive third. But that, looking at the numbers that you've put in the piece, definitely not the strategy out of possession for this Dortmund side at the moment.
No, not at all. I mean, Dortmund's PPDA in the group stages was the 13th best, so showing that they weren't really pressing opponents that high. They looked to be more of a possession-based team, and they kind of dominated possession most of the time with the fifth highest average. So, yeah, it definitely seems like a departure from what we'd expect from the kind of classic Dortmund sides of yesteryear. Yeah, I think that I'm probably agree with Michael here that this could be kind of the round or the tie of the round where we could see an upset. We have got another American, Gio Reyna, on the left hand side even for Dortmund, which would be interesting to see how he gets on in this tie too. And Marco Reus has always been someone who's been kind of blighted with injuries throughout his career, and as Michael notes in the piece, he's kind of barely lasted 90 minutes in recent games as well. So I expect to see kind of him changed out. It seems that the two defensive mids of Delaney and Witsel are fairly well set, although Jude Bellingham he's been playing of late as well. So, yeah, it's funny. It just feels like a Dortmund side, maybe, that is just kind of waiting for the summer and waiting to get Rose in and really kind of kickstart things.
Yeah, what do you think about the appointment of Marco Rose? Michael, what can you tell me about him?
Yeah, it feels inevitable. Another very good coach from the German school. I think maybe comparable to Nagelsmann, big formation switcher, clearly likes intense play and works a lot on build-up play, which is maybe a little bit different from the kind of Klopp approach of a decade ago. I think the German school has incorporated a lot more of Guardiola's methods. His assistant is René Maric, who has been very prominent on Twitter in recent years. So I think a few of us know him through that method. There's actually a great interview with him by Raphael Honigstein on the site, probably about a year ago now, but that's really worth checking out. Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, I do find the Bundesliga slightly frustrating in that Dortmund and Bayern do just seem to pick off the best coaches and the best players from the sides that are challenging them, which I guess is inevitable, but it does create quite a predictable league table. And it's also, you know, the same with Bayern getting up in Meccano. Why is it being announced now? It just almost makes half the season a bit of an afterthought, doesn't it? I find it quite frustrating. But yeah, it will be fun next season, but next season is 6 months away, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm intrigued by Rose because it just feels like he's risen so quickly throughout the ranks in Europe. I mean, he was Salzburg's under 18 coach in 2017, and just 4 years later now he's going to be moving to Dortmund in the summer. So it seems like he, you know, he's obviously doing something right. I think he has a good track record for player development, even in a short period of time. I think that he's also recruited fairly well as well. Rami Bansabani is one player at fullback for Mönchengladbach, who I think was bought fairly cheaply and has performed pretty well and puts up really, really solid numbers for a fullback in Europe. He's still squeezing stuff out of Lars Stindl, who seems like he's been around Mönchengladbach forever. And, I mean, Marcus Thuram, of course, as well, who was an A signing, one that, if you looked at the data a few years ago, you would have plucked out as someone who was getting a lot of chances at a young age and was, I guess, quite raw and not the finished product, but he was a very, very serviceable winger or a striker. And now, you know, he's probably added another zero to his price tag.
Squeezing stuff out of Lars Stindl. What a phrase that was. What a... Wow, I can really picture it. Right, next up is Porto against Juventus. Really enjoyed reading your write-up on Porto on site, Michael. Quite an interesting side. And dare I say it, potentially under Sergio Conceição, possibly quite well suited to knockout football.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit like with PSG earlier, I do find it difficult really to watch the games in the Portuguese league, of which I've seen a couple of Porto this season, and work out how that would transfer to playing against really good opponents. But yeah, the Champions League group stage, they lost first up to Manchester City and then kept 5 clean sheets in a row. They're very compact, they're very well organised. They usually play 4-4-2, but for their second game against City, they went 5-3-2 and obviously kept a clean sheet. So maybe that's an option here against Juventus. I'm not completely convinced by Marega and Taremi up front. They seem like the type of forwards who will be good in Portugal, but maybe not so much in the knockout stage. But yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing them. I just always enjoy watching Porto sides. I think they always play very cohesive, very structured football. And I think Conceição is a good manager as well. He's been there quite a while, actually, by the standards of Porto managers over the last decade. So, yeah, this could be an interesting game.
Tom, in terms of style of play, the numbers suggest that they're kind of at one end of the spectrum, depending on whether we're talking about build-up play or pressing. They tend to be at the extreme end, one way or another.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can see from the charts and the piece that they definitely are a side that favours the long ball. They have a really high share of their passes, which are long. Barely any possession in the final third. They're averaging 6.3 shots a game, so don't exactly expect maybe a lot of shooting from them, but the shots they did have were of really, really high quality as well. So, yeah, I think for me, arguably Porto are the most exciting side in the competition that are left, because they're the sort of team which I just barely know anything about and don't really know much about any of the players in the squad or on the team sheet. So, I mean, they're the only side left in the competition that aren't in the top five leagues. So that's always a bit of fun, really.
Yeah, absolutely. They're up against Juve, Michael, under Andrea Pirlo. What's his Juve side look like? What defines them?
Yeah, they're quite interesting. They're probably more interesting than they are good because their results have been inconsistent this season. I mean, the formation is interesting. It's probably 4-4-2 without the ball, but it becomes more like 3-5-2 with the ball. So they have one fullback who pushes on, and then the wide midfielder down that side will then move inside to become a number 10. It's often been Aaron Ramsey doing that. So that in itself, I think, is quite interesting. And they can vary it. They do it on one side one game and then the other side the next game. So yeah, Pirlo, he's got some interesting methods. I mean, it's been a bit of a difficult first season for him. I mean, it's bizarre that he's in charge, really. He was going to be in charge of the youth team and suddenly got promoted after a few days. I don't quite know what he's doing in charge, but yeah, it's been difficult in the league. I'm not sure they're going to win the league for the first time since, 2011. But in the Champions League, I think they could cause some problems. I would expect them to get through this game. And it's a very obvious bit of analysis. But Cristiano Ronaldo over the last decade has quite consistently, I'd say, been on a side that has been struggling in a game and has then scored a couple of brilliant goals to take his side through. He is, you know, maybe the best Champions League player we've seen without wanting to go down a very familiar debate. And I think, you know, with him in the side, Juventus can play on the counter-attack. They can cross the ball. They can play possession football. I think he's rejuvenated his game since moving to Italy, Ronaldo. He's obviously the main man, but we shouldn't underestimate quite how much of a difference he can make.
Lots of interesting players in this Juve side. Tom, Ronaldo and Morata up top. Of course, Dybala is still a magnificent player as well. Still Chiellini and Bonucci in the heart of the defence and Szczęsny in goal as well. What about Juan Cuadrado, though? Because, I mean, the current Juan Cuadrado is very different to the one that we saw briefly in the Premier League with Chelsea.
Yeah, it's funny. He's yet another on that list of kind of Chelsea flops who've gone on to have pretty decent careers elsewhere. Yeah, I mean, he was joint with Messi in the group stages for goal-creating actions, which essentially is assists, but also counts fouls that are drawn that maybe lead to free kicks and goals, which are then scored, free kicks and penalties, sorry, that are then scored, dribbles past players before a goal is scored, things like that. So it's a bit of a larger net, I guess, to give credit to players, to depending on what happens before a goal is actually scored. And he's done 7 of these goal-creating actions. So yeah, he's having a really big impact down the right-hand side. I've always kind of enjoyed watching Cuadrado. He feels like a very unpredictable player. And yeah, I think he's definitely one to watch. Very, very different from Danilo, who is definitely a very defensive-minded fullback, although one who's far more capable of playing both on the left and right-hand side. So yeah, excited to see him. Morata as well this season is kind of, I think I've written about it before with James Horncastle fairly recently, that he's having a really solid career, both in terms of assisting and scoring. So expect Ronaldo to be kind of the ultimate poacher and move finisher, and Morata very much the kind of link-up striker.
Atletico Madrid against Chelsea is yet another smashing fixture, I have to say. A really exciting tie, especially with Tuchel now in charge of Chelsea and the way that they've started under Tuchel. From an Atleti perspective, Michael, I mean, they're 5 points clear at the top of La Liga with 2 games in hand. What makes them so good?
Yeah, they're a really good team. I mean, they've completely changed system, really, from the Atleti we've seen for much of the last decade. It's not 4-4-2 or some variation. It's 3-5-2, probably 3-5-1-1 with João Felix floating behind Luis Suarez. They look very rejuvenated. I mean, I've been amazed how well Luis Suarez has done. I know it's the common thing now to say what a mistake Barcelona made letting him go. But, I mean, he looks from his last legs at Barcelona. No one expects him to be this good, not just, you know, scoring goals, but running the channels, looking mobile, looking fit, looking motivated. I must say, people probably don't listen to this pod for betting tips, but Atleti are 6th favourites. They're 16-1. I find that staggering. They're the best team in Spain by a mile. Looking at the list, I mean, they're better than Liverpool at the moment, no question. They're certainly better than Juventus. And PSG always a bit of an unknown because of the step up. But, I mean, Atleti have such a good record of getting through two-legged ties. Simeone's the master in those situations. And, yeah, more than ever, I think they are actually a really good football side. They're not just a team who try and be wily and sneak through. I think they're a football team who can outplay their opponents. So I really like the look of them. And I think they're a very big danger to the... I think Bayern and City are the outright favourites, but I would have Atleti in third behind them.
Tom, Suarez does appear to have, I don't know, made a sacrifice to the XG gods of some sorts. 8.1 non-penalty expected goals in La Liga, 14 non-penalty goals. That's going to get you where you want to go, I think.
Absolutely. I think that he's definitely having a great season and probably brings out the best in João Felix as well. There's some great videos going around on Twitter not so long ago of just him creating chances for Alvaro Morata, and if you had a more clinical finisher, he's going to start racking up assists. So yeah, intrigued to see those two up front. Intrigued to see Thomas Lemar in midfield as well on kind of the left-hand side, which is something I've never really expected to see, but I feel it makes sense. I mean, he's not the most dynamic player physically, speed-wise, and that's why kind of Yannick Carrasco is playing that left wing-back role. But I think Lemar is really kind of nice, technically well-gifted player, and adds a good level of passing in midfield. But yeah, I mean, the biggest thing with Atleti is the formation has changed, but the game plan will be the same. They only scored 7 goals in the Champions League group stages, which is fewer than all other teams. So it's going to be very much drag this tie kicking and screaming to the 80-90th minute and try and nick it 1-0. That's what I expect Simeone to try and do.
Michael, based on what we've seen so far from Chelsea under Tommy Tactics, this could be a real game of cat and mouse, one on a knife edge full of tension.
Yeah, I mean, I think the pattern of the game is pretty obvious, as Tom says. I mean, Chelsea have dominated possession quite clearly in every game under Tuchel so far. Yeah, I think they'll have the ball. They'll be trying to look for openings, and Atleti will probably play on the counter-attack and for set pieces and be a little bit old-school Atleti. Probably a clash of 3-man defences. I always think the wing-backs are crucial. It'd be interesting to see who Chelsea use them. And Hudson-Odoi, I think, has been very impressive as a wing-back and indeed as a kind of floating forward as well. But Carrasco for Atleti, I think, is in big games this season has been really good, particularly in the win over Barcelona. He was basically playing as a fifth defender and then almost the most prominent attacking threat going forward with his real surging runs. So, yeah, this is a really interesting game. Like I say, I'm a big Atleti fan this season. I think they're looking really good. So I would have them favourites to go through from this one.
Tom, what have you got to add on Chelsea? I sort of feel like any group stage data that you could throw at me feels almost irrelevant now, given how much things have changed in such a short space of time since Lampard left and Tuchel came in.
Yeah, I mean, what we see in the data is that they were very direct for Chelsea in the group stages, which was something of a surprise. They were kind of about average for possession and possession in the final third. So I would expect those things to kind of change around. I think that Chelsea will dominate possession far more, and their data in the knockout rounds versus group stage will be entirely different. And they're also below average in terms of pressing, which I'm intrigued to see how that changes as well.
Lazio against Bayern. Michael, for Lazio, it's the first time in 2 decades that they've reached this stage of the Champions League. Certainly good to have them back, for memories of that team from the early 2000s. And the manager, Simone Inzaghi, was playing up top then. What's he like as a manager? What's this Lazio side built on?
He's a very good manager. And I must say, I never really liked him much as a player. I never really understood what he was all about. But he's a very good manager. They play 3-5-2, maybe 3-5-1-1. A little bit similar to Atleti in that respect. Maybe a different game plan. They play some really nice possession football, lovely midfield patterns. I like the fact that both Milinkovic-Savic and Luis Alberto play in the midfield. That's a very attacking tilt. I watched their game against Inter on Sunday night. They were really unlucky to be 2-0 down. Played some really good football. I quite liked Acerbi popping up from left-sided centre-back to get into the attack, almost playing the Jack O'Connell role for those of us who like Sheffield United. I think they're the oldest team in Europe in the top five leagues. So you can sometimes tell that. I mean, Lucas Leiva's playing holding midfield. I mean, that kind of sums it up without wanting to be unkind to Lucas.
Well, plenty of experience in the dressing room, albeit potentially not so much on this particular stage. They're up against Bayern Munich, Michael, the favourites to win the thing. They obviously last season romped to victory. They scored 18 goals this year in the group stages. Is the reality of Bayern at the moment under Flick as solid as my last sentence makes it seem?
Yeah, they're pretty good. I mean, they've kind of been doing this thing where they haven't really been impressing, but they've been winning, which has taken them clear of the Bundesliga, at the top of the Bundesliga. Pretty similar side to last year. Thiago's not there. Kimmich has moved forward into midfield, where obviously he's played many times before. I wouldn't be surprised if they did have one game where they suddenly collapse a bit, just because I think that high defensive line, you depend upon such intensity. And if it drops off for even a minute, you can really suffer. That said, I think they're going to wrap up the league early and they'll be able to concentrate on the Champions League when it gets to the quarterfinal, semi-final stage. Probably only Manchester City are also in that position of all these sides left in the competition. I'm excited about this game. I'll go out of my way to watch it. I think Lazio might be really impressive, but also lose the tie about 5-1, just because I think Bayern are really, really good at their best.
I mean, numbers-wise, Tom, Bayern are very, very strong in basically any category, any metric that you could choose.
Yeah, I guess apart from at the back, they conceded the second most shots in the group stages, and they were kind of the fourth highest quality on average as well. So I think defensively, they've not been the same this season. I remember we spoke about them on the pod recently, and I think they're about ranked eighth or ninth in the Bundesliga in terms of XG against per game. So that's one thing to look out for sure. If Ciro Immobile and Felipe Caicedo can actually cause them some damage, and yeah, that's the one thing that will really hold them back from retaining their title this year.
Atalanta against Real Madrid is another absolute cracker. Michael, Atalanta, I think it's still fair to say that they're the neutral's choice. I think that is correct. You wrote during the group stages about their game against Ajax. It's one of my favourite of your tactical breakdowns. In it, you spoke about Atalanta's rotating diamonds, but they come into this a diamond down, in a sense, with Papu Gomez having fallen out with Gasperini and left the club in January. I mean, can we expect more thrilling football from Atalanta up against Real Madrid?
Yeah, they won't change their approach, and they haven't changed their approach from last year. I think Papu Gomez is a big miss. I think it'll be a fun game. The rotation down the flanks, like you say, will ask questions of Real Madrid and their capacity for their forwards to get back and defend. But Atalanta, they do play this very risky man-marking style, and I think some of the rotation from Real Madrid and their attackers could cause problems. So, yeah, this will be a fun game. Real Madrid favourites, but I would love to see Atalanta cause a bit of an upset.
What makes them sort of stand out, I guess, Tom, in terms of their style of play, Atalanta, they definitely like to move it.
Yeah, I mean, they attack with a lot of speed and they're the kind of quickest team in the group stages in terms of how quickly they move the ball upfield. They pass fairly long. I mean, they were the fourth highest team in terms of the share of passes which they make, which are long. So, I'm intrigued to see them play against Real. They're creating really high quality chances. I think one player who could be quite pivotal in the tie, although he won't start the game, will be Luis Muriel, who's having an amazing season off the bench so far. I mean, I put it on Twitter a few weeks ago. He's essentially just having a substitution-based season for the ages. He's scoring loads. He's not completed a game. I think he's completed one game in 2 years. Yeah, he's got 13 goals in about 670 minutes. So his average per game is, I mean, it's over one goal a game. And in terms of goals plus assists, he's averaging 2 per 90. So it's just incredible numbers despite being a tiny sample. So if he comes off the bench, he's someone who has been really, really good. He just seemingly can't stay fit.
Well, I think in fairness as well, Duvan Zapata, another Atalanta striker, is also putting up some pretty impressive numbers. I mean, in terms of just looking at FB Ref and their new brilliant scouting report tool, non-penalty XG, 94th percentile in the top five Euro leagues as well. So certainly plenty for Real Madrid and their centre-backs specifically to sort of keep a hold of. Michael, on that note, there's still the sort of key personnel, I guess, both in the dugout and on the pitch in many ways for Real Madrid that have won this thing a number of times previously. What sort of shape are they in this year?
Yeah, they're they've really suffered from injuries in the last couple of weeks, actually going back longer than that, but they've been a little bit more interesting than usual at times. I saw their game against Getafe last week. Zidane used a very unusual system with Marcelo playing as the left wing back and drifting into central midfield and then Mendy overlapping him. Yeah, I'm not sure about Real Madrid. To be honest, I've never been sure about them under Zidane. I've been amazed they've won this competition three times. Probably only one of those years where they're actually the best team in the competition. The midfield trio is the one, you know, it's a very solid one that we've come to know with Casemiro and Modric and Toni Kroos when he comes back from injury. Benzema is key. I mean, he's kind of spent much of the last decade playing a kind of supporting role for Cristiano Ronaldo, but we're now seeing that he's a brilliant player in his own right. I think they will need Benzema to have a extraordinary knockout stage to win this competition. Mm-hmm. But yeah, obviously start as the favourites for this game against Atalanta.
They've had kind of an interesting relationship, Tom, with pressing this year, with how they press teams in the final third. In terms of the numbers, quite good, but in terms of a piece that you and Dermot Corrigan wrote the other day, not always that well structured, not always that well organised.
Yeah, that was an observation Dermot made, essentially saying that they seemingly don't have a good structure to their pressing, and if teams beat them, they completely fall apart, which I think is very much the case. I mean, they conceded the highest average quality shot in the group stages, and I think that's something similar that transcends across their league form as well. They're 12th for PPDA, which is it's not great either. It shows that they aren't consistently putting a lot of pressure on the ball. But on the other side of things, they average the most high turnovers, which are essentially you're winning possession back in the final third in open play, and that was the most joint with Man City on 36. So if they can pressure at the right times, it's effective, but I think that press is susceptible to be broken, and for Atalanta's diamond midfield and wing backs, they will be looking to hunt and feast on that, and hopefully that's the way they're going to win the tie.
Eighth and final tie to preview in this epic round of 16 preview with Michael Cox and Tom Warville. Borussia Mönchengladbach against Manchester City. We'll start with Gladbach and that man, Marco Rose, already referenced in this piece, current Gladbach boss, future Dortmund manager. Michael, how would you explain to me what Marco Rose has done with this Gladbach side that has caught the eye of Dortmund? What does this side look like?
Yeah, obviously we spoke about them earlier. I mean, very tactically flexible, good at pressing, good in terms of possession play, lots of rotation in terms of the starting 11. They're very hard to predict. As Tom said, Lars Stindl is very crucial for them. The actual attackers, I think, it's a bit of a mix and match situation for different opponents, so it's hard to guess how they will play. And they do have a midfield duo who can command the game. I fear they might be a little bit pulled around here by Manchester City, who are in really, really good form, having been not impressive at all before Christmas. So yeah, of all the eight ties, this is the one I would be most certain of the result going one way.
And Tom, probably in keeping with his reputation as a dynamic, intellectual and studious young coach, is that Gladbach have an excellent set-piece record, very innovative when it comes to creating chances from set-pieces, that most wonderful of marginal gains, which is not marginal at all, actually, but very, very tangible.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they scored the most goals from set-piece in the group stage with four, but again, that whole thing of context comes into it. All four were against Shakhtar Donetsk. One game they won 6-0, the other they won 4-0. So definitely worked in those ties. But whether that, again, is something that they can use against slightly better teams remains to be seen.
And Coxie, they're up against Pep Guardiola's Man City. Is it 15 wins in a row for City? They are essentially the joint favourites with Bayern Munich. Those two are the ones to beat, I think it's fair to say. A lot of people hoping for a Bayern-Man City final, but there's a lot to come before that can be the case. I mean, it's a big question for a small space of time, but what on earth has Pep Guardiola done since that poor start to the season, where we spoke about their tactical issues with Sam Lee on this pod, to rattle off 15 games in a row without Sergio Aguero for the most part, without Kevin De Bruyne for the most part? I mean, what is going on there?
Yeah, it's been completely crazy, hasn't it, really? I mean, in terms of their improvement, I think the key thing to remember here maybe is the fitness issues. I mean, both them and Manchester United had slightly disrupted pre-seasons because they were playing in European competition late. And both Manchester United and Manchester City started really bad and have picked up in different ways. I mean, the way they're playing at the moment, I think, is as fluid a side as I've seen from Guardiola. Cancelo coming in from right back to be a deep-lying playmaker, really, alongside Rodri in the middle. And that's allowed Gundogan to push forward and become the most prolific player in the Premier League over the last couple of months, which is incredible, really, when you consider he was a really good all-round midfielder, but not really much of a goal scorer. And then we've seen great fluidity up front, like you say, without De Bruyne. They've been more, more cohesive in terms of the creativity. Without Aguero and sometimes Jesus, they've played a very fluid system. Foden was up front, really, in the Liverpool game, was drifting around everywhere. Sterling and Mahrez and Bernardo Silva are popping up in the box as well. I think they're actually starting to look like a really, really good team. I mean, they're going to run away with the Premier League. And that will give them a little bit of license to maybe concentrate on these games, whether that's tactically in training and in preparation or rotating players for the Premier League game beforehand. So, look, Guardiola's gone a long time. It's going to be a decade, really. You know, only nine of those 10 years will he have been actually competing in the Champions League. But for him to go that long without a Champions League victory is incredible. And I think they've got a very good chance of putting that record straight this time around.
Hey, Tom, let's finish with some clickbait. What would you say if I said to you, Pep Guardiola, best offensive coach in the world right now?
Yeah, I think it just shows that possession is as much of an attacking tool as a defensive one. And, you know, you can't concede goals when you have so much of the ball like City do. So I just think that City, you know, the way they defend is just not giving up the ball or not giving it up easily. They're counter-pressing really well this season. I think the key to them is just, and I think Michael just mentioned it then, but they're rotating so well. They're a nightmare for fantasy Premier League owners, but you've not seen that level of rotation with the likes of Liverpool, likes of other teams who are essentially in the title race as well. And I think it's paid off really well. I mean, Joao Cancelo's not started every game. Kyle Walker and him have kind of shared minutes at right back. Fernandinho's actually played a bit at defensive midfielder again to save Rodri's legs. We haven't mentioned Ruben Diaz yet, but he's been a revelation for City so far this season, in the way that he's not a classic kind of really eye-catching on the ball defender. He's more of a kind of physical defence first one, but he's been fantastic. And I can't remember the last time that Guardiola had a player like that in this system. It just feels like for so long he would prioritise those who are tactically and technically excellent, and defensively excellent goes much further down the list of things that he needs. But I'm really excited to see how City get on this year. I mean, they're kind of favourites for a reason, and they're not even firing all cylinders. I don't think Raheem Sterling's playing that well recently. I don't think Gabriel Jesus is playing that well, but the system as a whole is is working really well, and I think that that is the thing that will win you games in the long run.
Brilliant. Well, we have tried our best to give a Champions League round of 16 preview that is at the same time concise and detailed, and that is podcasting nirvana is what we've approached there. So hopefully, listener, you've enjoyed this. Michael and Tom bringing the goodness as ever. If you want to read the preview in written form, theathletic.com/zonal marking is where you can sign up for an Athletic subscription for less than £1 a week, really. There's a half price offer at the moment on annual subscriptions. And for those of you who are already subscribers of the site, please do go and play the Champions League quiz on the site at the moment. It's brilliant. It's very, very tough. I mean, do not be put off by the current top comment below the line on this piece, on this quiz, I should say, which says, "This is a really stupid quiz. Guessing missing semi-finalists, guessing finals locations, gave up after 12 questions. Utterly pointless." I reckon there's people listening here for whom guessing missing Champions League semi-finalists and guessing final locations is about as good as it gets when it comes to football quizzing. So head to the site now. We will finish off with some answers from my own teasers from the very top of the pod. Let's start with Tom's guess for who were the first two Englishmen to score in a Champions League final, because I have a feeling Michael knows the answer and I want to give Tom a chance to get in front of it.
I think you should go route one to Michael so I don't embarrass myself.
Coxie, you are the Zonal Marking Podcast's resident quizzer. Who were the first two Englishmen to score in a Champions League final?
I think Teddy Sheringham must have been first, yes, with the equaliser in 99. And then the second one, presumably, is the next year, I think, is Steve McManaman.
Teddy Sheringham in 99, Steve McManaman in 2000. Very good, Fletch. Very good. The second question is, in the 2004 Champions League final between Monaco and Porto, this was a bit wordy, wasn't it? Monaco had three forwards on the bench, Dado Perso, Shabani Nonda, and one other. Perso and Nonda both came off the bench in this game, but the unused sub forward went on to have a brilliant career playing for four Premier League clubs and also for Real Madrid, but never appeared in a Champions League final. Tom, any ideas?
I think it's Emmanuel Adebayor.
Yes, very good. It absolutely is Emmanuel Adebayor, who I have to admit, did not know was on the bench for Monaco in the 2004 Champions League final. Coxie, did you get that one?
I did get that one, yes. And I'm just looking at whether he was on the bench in the 2006 Champions League final. No, he wasn't. He wasn't, I'm afraid. No. Dennis Bergkamp and Robin van Persie and Jose Antonio Reyes were, but no Adebayor. Must have come the next January, I think.
Well, let's leave it there for this week's pod. Thank you both guys for a gargantuan effort putting together all this info on 16 sides that will form our round of 16 in the Champions League. I cannot wait. I hope you guys enjoy watching it as much as we will, and hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Make sure you're subscribed to the podcast feed so that you can catch next week's episode and all subsequent Zonal Marking podcasts brought to you by The Athletic. Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk again soon.
The Athletic.